Welcome to Vinay Assurance Based Medrash Program, Summer Learning Program. It's a great honor to have Rav Weil present the Shirim series during the summer. Our learning during the summer, both the morning kollel and the evening Shirim that we've had, is for Refuah Shlema for Chaim Yisachar and Chaim Mushkat and all Holy Israel. May they all have a speedy Refuah Shlema. The cover gadol for a while.
Henry, thank you very much. This evening, I apologize, we may have to share. I don't know if we have enough of the sources. I'm sorry about that. This evening, we probably won't be able to get into the text to the degree that we'd like, meaning we'd need an extra half an hour. What we're going to do is do the shiur and the discussion outside and then allude to the text itself. There are three of the kinos that deal with the aftermath of what happened in Germany in 1096, the First Crusade, the People's Crusade, as opposed to the French Crusade, which was very different. We're going to analyze kinos 22 and 25. You'll see why there's a piece of 22 and a piece of 25 that's crucial to us. But before we even touch the sources, what I'd like to do is give a certain context, which will take us about almost half the shiur till we actually get to the events of 1096. Let me start with this point. Our whole observance of the Svira is Ashkenazim. Our Svira starts at Rosh Chodesh Iyar, and it goes through Shlosh Yemei Hagbalah. That's very strange for the following reason. Originally, we, the Ashkenazim, observed Svira Sa'omer the same as the Spartan. When would Svira start? The beginning of the Svira. Lag Ba'omer would be the end of the Svira. We'll explain what happened at Lag Ba'omer. But you had, essentially, the primary minhag of the Jewish people was the first part of the Svira. What some people did was they actually would observe the whole Svira, with the exception of Lag Ba'omer. But the mainstream community observed the minhag, the beginning. Why all of a sudden did the Ashkenazim, we changed it? Ashkenazim, now we don't observe the beginning of the Svira. We observe starting Rosh Chodesh Iyar until Shlosh Yemei Hagbalah. So that's a question we're going to come back to, but it's an important question, and it will reflect upon our discussion. That's the first point. Second point to think about is, if the tragedy, the destruction of Ashkenaz, of German Jewry, of the Balei HaMasorah, which we'll get into, took place at the 23rd of Iyar, roughly through the 3rd of Sivan, those are the major communities that were destroyed. There was destruction after that, but that was the primary time. Why do we observe this tragedy when? On Tisha B'Av. The destruction of Ashkenaz didn't happen on Tisha B'Av. It happened in May and June of 1096, Iyar and Sivan of Tatnu, Taftas Nun Vav. Just hold that question as well. Here's where I'd like to start. With the exception of the Rambam and possibly the Rav Yoff, most, the large preponderance of French, of German, of Svartic Rishonim, of Provençal Rishonim, these Rishonim observed that they viewed our Svira Bizman Hazer, Svira Sa'omer, as strictly being Midrabanan. We can't bring the Omer, right? The breadbasket of Israel, the Kansas and Nebraska of Israel, are those Judean hills. They would go out after Havdalah with the sickles. You know, today we have a John Deere combine. We'd go to the area of the Gush, beautiful, plush area. Harvest, like in Sefer Rus, right, in Megillus Rus, you'd harvest it. You'd bring it along, and they had the valley that we call Highway 60. They didn't have actually the tunnel roads, so it was a little bit of a, more of a schlep. They would go to Yerushalayim, and that next morning they would bring the first grain. The wheat had yet to ripen. The first grain was barley, right? They would bring the barley. That was the Omer. And that whole notion of the count is contingent upon the bringing, what's called the Hakrovas HaOmer. So the Baal HaMa'or makes a very simple question. Yes, a very simple question. Why is it that during the Svira, we don't say Shechayanu? Right? Whenever we first start a mitzvah, the first time you bench Lulav and Esrog, the first time you're going to read the Megillah, the first time you do this, that, or the other, you always shechayanu v'kimanu v'higyanu, as man is that. We're very excited, we're happy. God brought us back to this point in our life where once again we could come to the cycle, you know, the galgal hachozer. We've reached this time of year. How come that doesn't exist by the Sfiris HaOmer? So the Baal HaMor, Rav Zerachya HaLevi, who was a provincial Rishon, a great provincial Rishon, he says, based upon the assumption we've been working with, what are you going to be happy about? Our whole Sfiris HaOmer is what? It's basically making a statement to God. We don't have the real McCoy. We can't go to the Judean hills. You know, this is nothing more than a skeleton. It's a pale shadow of the real mitzvah. But we do it, so there should be a krechs. You know, we do it because we're sad and we wish and yearn for the day when we can do it the proper way. I'll give you an example. In the Gemara in Menachos, there was an Amora, his name is Amemar. It says, Amemar mane yome velo mane shvue. He would only count the days during the sphere, he wouldn't count the weeks. Why not count both? Mitzvah to count the days and the weeks. Because he was reflecting and demonstrating that everything we're doing is nothing more than a moaning and a crex over the fact that we can't have the real bona fide sphere. So that was what sphere was. It was this concept of the Zecher L'Churban. Again, the Rambam's going to disagree with what I just said, but almost all Sephardic, Provençal, French, and German Rishonim take that approach. Until a certain event happened. It's what we call the Bar Kokhba Revolt. To be honest with you, it's really the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba Revolt. Let me just make a following comment. And again, you'll see where we're going with this. The Bar Kokhba Revolt, based upon the historians, either takes place 130 to 133 or 132 to 135. But wherever it takes place, it's about six and a half decades after what famous event? The destruction of the Churban, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, why is that significant? Because if you're a Jew in the time of the Bar Kokhba Revolt, what's your whole historical context of Gullus, of the period of Churban? 70 years, exactly. Why? The first time around when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in 586 before the Common Era, 52 years later, Cyrus, Kurash, allows the Jews to go back to what? To go back and reestablish Israel. 18 years after that, I mean, let me take it back. 15 years after that, there's a famous event, what we call the story of Purim. Right? Where the genocide decree is averted, and the Jewish people now are in a position of strength. 3 years after the Purim story, Ahasuerus dies, his son Darius, till this day the Persian Jews, the Iranian Jews, name their boys Daryush. What's Daryush? Daryavesh in Hebrew or Darius in English. After Ahasuerus' son, who was philo-Semitic, who was under the influence of a stepmother by the name of Esther, under the influence of a prime minister by the name of Mordechai, and what happened? The Jews are able to rebuild. It's a pale shadow of what it was, but we're able to rebuild what? The Beis HaMikdash. So if you're a Jew in the time of the Bar Kokhba Revolt, you don't have to be Lubavitch to have messianic feelings. You don't have to, you know what I mean? Because your whole historical context is, it's going to happen. 70 years is the period of the destruction, and it's going to happen. Okay? Keep that in mind for a second. Go back just one more time. Our focus for the next 10-15 minutes is going to be the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba Revolt. But we need to spend 2 minutes on the Churban Beis HaMikdash to give us a context. We've all been to Gamla in the Golan Heights, right? You go to the winery, you go to Gamla, you go to Katzrin, you know, the whole Mishneic community there. But what's in Gamla? That was the first major battle against the Romans in 66 of the Common Era. And you've all heard the story about how the Jews poured the hot oil on, and it was a very difficult. But many Romans lost their lives, a lot of casualties. Once they finally broke through and defeated Gamla, they slaughtered, they butchered the Jews of Gamla. And we know that the Jews of Gamla, by their own admission, by the historical records we have, the archaeological finds we have, they viewed the Battle of Gamla as a defense of Jerusalem. It was the first major defense up on the Golan Heights. The Roman soldiers now come straight through the Galilee. So one of the great battles, and we could talk about this another year when we learn the 10th Kinnah, was the battle in Yudfat. We call it as Ashkenazim Yudfas. What's Yudfat? Anyone been to Tzipori? Right? The University of Michigan has the archaeological dig there. Anyone been to a fascinating community called Mitzpeh Hoshaya? You ever see the kids around Teaneck? They're walking around with these t-shirts, do it on a donkey? That's from Mitzpeh Hoshaya. That's where Elazar Stern, many famous Jews, Danny Stotman, professor at Haifa University. What happened in Yudfat? It's the lower Galilee, central Galilee. There was a major fortified city, and the Romans again couldn't get through. We're spending a lot of time trying to get through. Finally, when they were about to break through, there was a suicide pact in Yudfat. And the leader of the Galilean revolt, we call him Yosef ben Matithyahu, the world knows him as Josephus Flavius. With the suicide pact, since he's the leader, he'll be the last one to commit suicide. You know, one by one, they'll make sure they'll kill each other. And then, instead of him committing suicide, what does he do? He tells the Romans, come on in, I've handed over the city. And eventually, after first being incarcerated, the Romans see the value this man has. He becomes the official chronicler, the official Roman historian of the war against the Jews. Why do you and I go to Tzipori? We look at these beautiful mosaic floors and the shuls and the beautiful city. Because the Jews in Tzipori were looking out their window and they were watching what was happening one mountain over in Yudfat. And they said, better to live and survive as a Roman vassal than to be a dead Jew. And they opened up the door, they opened up the city. There was no war, there was no battle in Tzipori. And that's why Tzipori survives, and eventually, 100 years later, when there's a reestablishment of a Sanhedrin, and there's a survival of the Jewish community in the north, the Mishnah is edited by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi with the Sanhedrin in Tzipori. That's why you and I can go there. That's why people from the University of Michigan, for the summer, they can, you know, if the weather's not so great in the Midwest, they can go make a dig in Israel. But with the exception of the Yudfat, the Romans come in, they just take over the Galilee. They come to the south of the country, they take it over. When do they get to Jerusalem? In 68. So from Gamla to Jerusalem wasn't very long, it was 2 years. You're all familiar with it, there's a 3-year siege of Jerusalem. It's a long battle, that siege. Vespasian is called back, he becomes a new emperor in Rome. He's not going to let this thing go. He's not giving up. He's not giving away to the Jews. What does he do? He brings in his own son, Titus of Russia. Titus, and Titus eventually destroys Jerusalem. The 17th of Tammuz breaks through the siege. Now, I don't know if we mentioned this last time, but imagine this. When we go to Jerusalem, you go into the Jaffa Gate. How long does it take us to walk from the Jaffa Gate to the Kotel? 10, 20 minutes, if one's enfeebled, 30 minutes? How in the world does a 12, 14 minute walk take 3 weeks? It takes from 17th of Tammuz till Tisha B'Av for the Romans to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. How does that happen? Because the Jews, particularly the Kohanim, the Jews who lived there, they fought hand-to-hand combat. I mean, of course they had weapons, but every inch of Jerusalem they were fighting over. They said that during those 3 weeks, the city was like a sea of blood. Roman and Jewish blood. It was an extremely bloody battle. Thousands upon thousands of people lost their lives in that last 3 weeks. Tisha B'Av, they destroy the Mikdash. It's actually the afternoon of the 9th of Av that Titus enters the Holy of Holies. Most of the physical destruction is the next day, but he enters the afternoon of the 9th of Av. What happens? One last holdout is not defeated, but there's a suicide pact in Masada in the year 72. So from 66 to 72, it's a 6-year war. There is an official history of this war, an official chronicles. It's glorious. The Romans have a pride about this. There's a parade, you know, like you have a ticker tape parade down Broadway. There's a parade. You know what the Arch of Titus is, describes that whole march, that parade. That, by the way, that war took 4 Roman battalions. A Roman battalion is 54,000 soldiers. Took 4 Roman battalions. Skip now. Let's go back to Bar Kokhba. Who's the emperor at the time? So in the Gemara we refer to him as Andaryavish. Hadrian in English. Hadrian sees, and by the way, I don't want you to think that I'm trying to spin Hadrian in a positive light. I'm not. I just want to make that clear. Hadrian sees what? You've got Jewish delegations coming to him saying, listen, what your Roman proconsuls are doing to us, what your governors are doing to us, they're destroying our whole ability to survive and to exist. Economically, they're raping us. We can't exist. It's not in your interest. You want taxes, you want income, you want revenues. We're literally the linchpin between the African continent and Asia Minor. Let us survive. Give us a chance. Hadrian, not because he's a Philo-Semite, but because it's good for the empire, he agrees to ease and abet the conditions for the Jews. We're probably talking now the late 120s. His own people, his Roman proconsuls, his governors, the people who are administering Judea. Who do you put first? A Jew or us? We're your people. You're sitting in Rome. We're here with these people. What are you doing? Who are you to make power? How do you do that to your own people? And Hadrian has a quandary, because on the one hand, it would be better for, on a macro level, to give the Jews a chance. It would, income-wise and all otherwise, it's better for Rome. But what happens? You can't, you know, you don't go against your own people. You don't want to have a revolt of your own leadership. So he has to ingratiate himself, and he's got needs the support of his own people. And what does he do? The pendulum swings. Instead of abetting and easing the quality of life, the tax conditions, the conditions in Judea, he squeezes, he tightens the knot. He makes it even more difficult on the Jews. The Jews have no choice. Our ancestors had no choice but to revolt. They couldn't live. Existence wasn't a life that you could live under those conditions. With what we said before, the context that what? The context that the Churban is supposed to last about 70 years, you had these messianic stirrings. Shimon, his name was not Bar Kokhba, his name was Shimon Bar Kosiba with a sin. They called him Bar Kokhba because of Darach Kochav Niyakov, the famous Nebuah of Bilam, right? Star will emerge, referring to the Mashiach. Why did they assume he was the Mashiach? It wasn't just Rabbi Akiva, it was the majority of the scholars. Because we have a principle. If you have someone who's a descendant of King David through the lineage of Solomon, which Bar Kokhba was, who leads the Jewish people according to the Torah Shebaal Peh and the Torah Shebichsav, and who is bringing success to the Jewish people, just keep in mind how successful Bar Kokhba was. They conquered Jerusalem, right? We reconquered Jerusalem. We have a government. You're all familiar with the Bar Kokhba coins. We actually have our own currency. We mint coins. Got a tremendously competent and capable army. And things are going very well. The tragedy of Bar Kokhba's success went to his head. It happens with many people. You get haughty. You start to attribute many of the successes to yourself. You lose your humility. And things went very sour, tragically. But in the aftermath of that war, remember we said there were four Roman battalions that it took to defeat Judea in 66 to 72? To defeat Bar Kokhba, it took 9 Roman battalions. Do you understand the magnitude, the challenge the Romans have in this war? One example, the great crack Roman battalion that was in Great Britain, they had to take it throughout the European continent, across the Mediterranean. They had to bring in, they had to move huge numbers of manpower from parts of the empire, from far off parts of the empire, just to defeat Bar Kokhba. This was a huge war. And I got to tell you, the Romans had it up to here. They were not, after this war, going to just say, okay, we fixed you, we showed you, now you know, go back to living your life. Oh no. They engaged what we would call crimes against humanity. They engaged in atrocities at this point. Now, we don't have great historical records because it was prohibited. They wouldn't keep the records of this. They didn't write about it, and they wouldn't allow us to write about it. But speculation is, we lost between 500,000 and 600,000 Jews. Not in the war. In the slaughtering, in the butchering, in the crimes against humanity, in the aftermath of the defeat of Bar Kokhba's revolt. Do you know what 500,000 to 600,000 Jews was? You're probably looking at close to 1/3 of world Jewry. The only other time in history where we lost 1/3 of world Jewry was when? It was 70 years ago. It was the Holocaust. That's what we're looking at. This is crucial, what we're going to say now. I'm quoting this. I heard this. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to give a shiur Sunday morning in Maimonides School in Boston. And when he was giving a shiur in 1970, he said that Gemara that we're all familiar with, that the 12,000 chavrusos, the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva, that they died of askara. Askara, if you translate it into English, is diphtheria. It's a pulmonological disease. The Rav said that's lashon sagi nahor. That's a euphemistic language. It's not so. That's not what happened. Those 24,000 students, to quote the Gemara, from Antipras. Antipras is a city in the northern Galilee named after Antipater, Herod's father. Ad Geva. Geva is in the south. Those 24,000 students that were the future of the Jewish people, that we're the Balei HaMesorah, the next generation, from the length, throughout the length and breadth of the nation, they were massacred. They were butchered. They were slaughtered by the Romans. They didn't die of the disease. They were killed. They were butchered. Because they were going to eradicate the future of the Jewish people. In the aftermath of the butchering and slaughtering, there's this whole phenomenon called the Hadrianic Decrees. We're going to talk about that next week, the Hadrianic Decrees. No public Jewish education allowed. By the way, you know where the Romans got the idea of these to legislate these Hadrianic Decrees? From Jewish apostates. The Rav quoted a Yerushalmi, Elisha ben Avuya was one of the Jewish apostates. It's not something they could have come up with on their own. You have to know the Jewish religion and Jewish law well enough. We never, ever had a history with the Romans. And we've been fighting them and having issues with them for well over 2 centuries. Take that back. For close to 3 centuries. We never had a history of religious persecution with the Romans. Now, in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt, in the aftermath of the butchering, the slaughtering, the Holocaust, yes. Because they realize the only way you're going to defeat the Jews is destroy Judaism. It sounds very similar to what the Greco-Syrians did leading up to the Hanukkah story. So what do? They killed the Balei HaMesorah. They destroyed the next generation. Now they prohibit public Jewish education. They prohibit what's called the conferring of smicha, the minui ha-smicha. And they make it a capital offense. 8 of the 10 martyrs that we'll talk about next week, 8 of those 10 martyrs were executed in defiance of the Hadrianic Decrees. In my opinion, and this is not fact, this is one man's opinion, maybe the greatest miracle in our history, greatest miracle in our history is that Rabbi Akiva, with this point now, we're talking either somewhere around 136, 135, somewhere in that range, is probably well over 100 years old. Why do I say that? Rabbi Akiva was at least 40 at the time of the Churban Beis HaMikdash, right? He started to become an budding, emerging scholar around the age of 40. Well, he was more than 40 at the time of the Churban. He wasn't the top scholar, he wasn't the Gadol HaDor, but he was close. He was emerging. We're now 60 some years later. He had every right to shrivel up, roll up, and die a depressed, broken, destroyed emotionally man. He had every right to do that. He didn't do that. He went out and he found five young men, stars. Five young men. Who knows if their parents survived the Bar Kokhba revolt? Rebbe Meir, the greatest of the five. Rebbe Shimon Bar Yochai. Rebbe Yehuda, the famous Rebbe Yehuda Bar Ilai. Rebbe Yehuda is important because after there's an abetment, an easement, a non-enforcement of the Hadrianic decrees a couple decades later, it's that Rebbe Yehuda who will reestablish the Sanhedrin in the north, and Usha and in the communities in the north. So you got Rebbe Meir, Rebbe Shimon, Rebbe Yehuda, Rebbe Yossi, and Rebbe Elazar ben Shamua. Those five. We don't know how many years Rebbe Akiva survives before they execute him. I don't think it was more than a couple. Maybe it was three. Not very long. But in the last years of his life, he gives everything he's got. After 24,000 of his students, after six decades of work, has been butchered and massacred, he transmits everything he can to those five students. Now, it's important to know who Rabbi Akiva is. This is crucial. He is the Gadol HaDor, he is the Baal HaMasorah. And I'm not just saying that. Rabbi Akiva had two primary teachers. Rabbi Yehoshua, who was one of the last of the school of Hillel, the base Hillel, and Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, Shamuti. What does that mean, Shamuti? He was one of the last of the school of Shammai. What does that mean? It's not just like today where we have the Keynesians and the monetarists, right? You've got the students of Milton Friedman from the University of Chicago, and where they've become professors and their students. And then you've got the Keynesians, you know, you've got guys who are primarily that school came, John Maynard Keynes obviously lived a long time ago, but you have the students that went to Harvard and developed the whole Keynesian school in Harvard. You've got other great institutions. And in, so to speak, we'll call it the Federal Reserve Bank and the Board of Governors there, within schools of economic advisors and economic think tanks, you've got these two great schools, the monetarists, the Friedmans, and the Keynesians. It was like that with the Jews. Why? Because until Herod, if you and I, let's say we're the Sanhedrin, I have an approach. I'm making a certain set of assumptions. You have an approach. You disagree with me. You're making a certain set of assumptions. And you know what? We're going to each bring proofs. We're each going to challenge logically, rationally. And you know, our peers will sit here. We'll discuss it back and forth. And in the end, there's going to be a vote. Acharei harabim lahatos. According to Parshas Mishpatim, there's going to be a vote. And that's the halacha. And there's one religion. There's one halacha. One Torah. And that was Judaism. What happened? Herod, now this is not our issue. We're talking about Herod. He leads the Jewish people, he leads Judea from 37 before the Common Era till 4 of the Common Era. You ever heard the phrase like a cat with 9 lives? Herod was a cat with 29 lives. Herod, one of the things, poor Dusharasha. One of the things that he does, he allows the Sanhedrin to function as a think tank. You want to have a yeshiva? I don't have a problem with that. But he prohibits it from legislating. The Sanhedrin, which is the Senate, the legislative body of the Jewish people, it's also the Supreme Court, the primary judiciary body. He tries to take away all sense of Jewish control, Jewish autonomy of Judea. He strengthens his own power, and he's got Rome backing him, and in turn he strengthens Rome's power. So from the time of Herod until the time of Rabbi Akiva, you don't have a Sanhedrin. You don't have a body that's paskening halacha, that's legislating. The one exception, those familiar with, I think it's Daf Yud Gimel in the Sefer Shabbos, the Yud Ches Davar, the 18 decrees, where the Beis Shammai, they went into seclusion with students of Beis Hillel, and they actually forced a vote. They defied the Herod's legislation, the Roman legislation. And he actually made a series of decrees of Jewish halakha, of legislation. We call them Yud Ches Davar. With that one exception, we have ended up not having a Sanhedrin that can determine one Torah, one halakha for the Jewish people. So we're actually split into two bodies, the Beis Shammai and the Beis Hillel. Guess what? Under Rabbi Akiva, there's now a unity. Once again, you've got the Baal HaMasorah, a student of the two tracks of the Masorah. You've now got a unity and a unifying factor of the Jewish people. He spends over six decades of his life producing students who literally will settle in every town, village, and city throughout the land. There's 24,000 of them. And his whole work is destroyed. It's eradicated. Judaism should have died. Not at that moment, but that should have been the death. And then the funeral would have taken a couple of decades, a couple of generations maybe. That didn't happen. Rabbi Akiva defied the Hadrianic decrees, and in these five young men, he saved our theology, which means he saved the Jewish people. By saving Judaism, he saved the Jewish people. But with that being said, we mourn the slaughter, the massacre, the butchering of the 24,000. As we said, for those who came late, the Rav said that term Askara was Lashon Saginor, was a euphemism. They didn't die of diphtheria. We couldn't record history of the capital offense. Very similar, I use an analogy. Any of you who've been to Treblinka, any of you who've been to Belzec, despite the amazing memorial that Michael Birnbaum, Professor Birnbaum, put up in Belzec, if you'd gone to Belzec 10 years ago, it was an empty field. You had no clue that hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed with carbon monoxide. It took them 25 minutes to gasp for breath as they were scratching into those walls on top of each other, dying a heinous death. You would have never known that. You would have thought it was a beautiful Polish farm site. There's no record of it. The Nazis removed any record of Treblinka, of Sobibor, of Belzec, of countless mass grave sites. That's what the Romans did in the aftermath of Bar Kokhba. They did not allow a record of history. And Judaism should have died then and there. Rabbi Akiva saved it. He gave his life trying to save it. He gave his life in defiance of that. It backfired, by the way, on the Romans. You know why it backfired? Because instead of the rest of the Jewish people being in awe and in reverence of the Romans, look at what they did to our holy, our righteous Rabbi Akiva. They took a man over 100 years old, and day after day until he finally expired, they took these iron combs and they wrenched him out. We've all been to Caesarea. We've all been to the Colosseum where they publicly executed Rabbi Akiva. It backfired. You know why? Because Rabbi Akiva became the rallying call. He became the flag that we bore. You know, we're not going to allow him to die for naught. And instead of people being afraid to engage in Jewish education, we defied the Romans. You had tens and hundreds of people that weren't Rabbi Akiva, but trying to do what he did. And it created just the opposite effect. And these five students saved Judaism. But nevertheless, we instituted, meaning the Jewish people, instituted a period of mourning. We mourn the loss of the Masorah. Could you imagine what Judaism would have been with 24,000 students? I'm not saying they were all Rebbe Meir. I'm not saying they were all Rebbe Shimon. But the Jewish people, remember, during that Bar Kokhba revolt, we were on the verge of the Messianic era. There were maybe two times in our history when we were on the verge of being the generation of Mashiach. One during Chizkiyahu's time, the time of the Bais Rishon, the story from Tanakh, and this time. That's how close we were. And that was all destroyed. And we mourn that. We mourn not just their loss, we mourn the loss of Judaism, the loss of the Masorah. It's a period of mourning where we mourn the Masorah. Why did it stop at Lag BaOmer, or according to those who kept the more stringent custom of all of Sphere with the exception of Lag BaOmer? The death stopped at Lag BaOmer. That's when the dying stopped. The dying, the murder stopped. The killing stopped. The point of Lag BaOmer is that Judaism would survive. That they didn't kill the old rabbi. They might have killed his students, but the old rabbi survived, and he was able to produce 5 new students, which Judaism would survive. Why did we just spend all of our time developing this? What the Sphira period emerged into? What we mourn during the Sphira? And I want to say it in one sentence. We're mourning the destruction of the Masorah. Repeat. We're mourning the destruction of the Masorah. Who was Rabbi Akiva? The Baal HaMasorah? What did he produce? What did he create for the Jewish people, which almost brought the Mashiach? And that was all wiped out and massacred. Why is that important? Now we'll see where we're going. So, in the aftermath of this, you're familiar with many of the enactments, not just the Hadrianic Decree, but the enactments that the Romans did. They renamed Jerusalem Aelia Capitolina. They put a pagan god on the Temple Mount. They actually plowed over meters of the Temple Mount. It shouldn't be this high place that we look up to. Now, we don't realize it today, because when we go to the Kotel, that's not really the ground level of the Kotel. That's after 2 millennia of rubble we're standing on. But when you go in the temple tunnels, you know, you go on the tour, you realize, you know, where ground level is. And they plowed over. They renamed the country. They made it a capital offense to call it Judea. They renamed it Palestina. Where did they get the name Palestina from? The Palestinian. The Romans were not necessarily very good historians, but their perception of Jewish history and their understanding of Jewish history. You want to slap the Jews in the face? Prohibit the city from being called Jerusalem. Put a pagan god on the Temple Mount. Plow over the Temple Mount. You want to embarrass the Jews? Go and find what you think are their worst enemy and rename their country after the worst enemy. Why they think the Palestinians? And you've been to Ashkelon. You ever see that Palestinian fortified fortress there? You, I know it's not good for them. This is huge fortification there in Ashkelon. You see how powerful they were. This is the group that killed Shaul HaMelech. This is the group that we read about throughout the Sefer Shoftim. This is the group that even David HaMelech, the great David, didn't defeat. They were always a thorn in our side. And they were a challenge. And they controlled the waterway, at least from the Gaza Strip through up about halfway up the Mediterranean. Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, north of that. So, something else they did. They imported, you could just imagine how many Jewish slaves were used for this. They imported thousands of tons of salt, and they plowed over the fertile soil of the land of Israel. Think about the Emek Yisrael, the Jezreel Valley. Think about the area now, when you go from Jerusalem, that fertile area is on your way to Ben Gurion. Jews couldn't live there. It was destroyed. It was all plowed over with salt. How are you going to produce anything? So the whole southern part of the country, the whole middle of the country becomes Judenrein. Just to give us a context. We couldn't figure out, you know, today, any of you you enjoy a premier wine, a fine wine, boutique wine. You know Castel, which always gets voted the top Israeli wine. The French vine, it's actually a French family. Geva family. We're saying to ourselves, that's what they were talking about in the Bible. That's what they were talking about in the Mishnah. And you know, the first 60 years of Israel, you know, nothing against the Rothschilds. God bless them that they, you know, started the Carmel winery and everything else. But we're saying, where is the great wine? You know, where is the great fertile soil of Israel? We just couldn't perceive it. You know why? Because after the Romans plowed over, most of the country was salt. It didn't produce. It didn't produce for 2 millennia. You understand? We could never. We hallucinated about the story of Ruth. You know, these beautiful, fertile areas in Bethlehem, right? Bethlehem. It's the Nebraska, the Kansas, the breadbasket of Israel. But our perception of it for 2 millennia is a bunch of barren, empty mountains. Well, you know, now go back there. Go to Ephrat. Go to the Gush. Go to Kfar Etzion, these communities in the Gush. And all of a sudden, it's not barren, empty mountains. All of a sudden, it's this plush, rich, fertile soil. And we realize that. Now the Tanakh comes to life. The Mishnah comes to life. But our perception until modern times was created by the Romans. It was created by the Romans. The Jews couldn't survive in Israel. You had Jewish communities in the north. You did. Up in the northern Galilee. We know where the Sanhedrin went. Usha, Shvaram, Beit She'arim, Tzipori, Tveria. But those are small communities. You had the big Roman port city, Caesarea. Now we're discovering in the Golan Heights some of the communities, through archaeological findings. Where did the Jews go, starting at the end of the 2nd century? Where did the Jews go? Where you could survive. Where you don't have Roman oppression. Where you can earn a living, where you can survive. So we went where? Where the American boys are fighting right now. Between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. We went to Babel, to Iraq. Why? Well, first of all, that land wasn't plowed over with salt. Secondly, that land, thank God, wasn't even Roman. Anyone ever hear of Zubin Mehta? Zubin Mehta, the head of the Israeli, the conductor of the Israeli Philharmonic? He's the only one I know today that's a Zoroastrian. At the time, we're talking now the end of the 2nd century, the beginning of the 3rd century, that 60 to 80 year period after the Hadrianic Decrees. The ones that controlled Babel were the Zoroastrians and the Parthians. And that's where the Jews lived. And we survived. We set up communities along the Euphrates River. The two most famous communities because of the great schools. We'll call it, you know, the Cambridge and Oxford, or the Princeton and Harvard, the Harvard and Yale of the Jewish people. Sura and Pompidisa. Sura and Pompidisa. The two great schools. So in the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, even into the 10th century, this became the place where 80 to 90%, depending on the century, 80 to 90% of world Jewry lived there. Because whether it was under the Parthians and Zoroastrians at the beginning, or after the great Islamic revolution, when the Muslims established Baghdad, right, what we call today Baghdad, when they established that as the capital, we could survive there. We could live in Babylonia. It worked for us. It wasn't perfect. Yes, there was anti-Semitism, but there was Jewish self-governance. We had a Reish Galusa. We had Jewish leadership, the rabbis, right, the Rosh Yeshiva. We lived. And by the way, it's not only because we know this from history. You've all heard of Solomon Schechter, right? What was he famous for? He did the great work on the Cairo Geniza. Well, look at what the Cairo Geniza says. What was the Cairo Geniza? Today, we bury Shamos. right? If a shul has a contract with a certain mortuary, so they throw in the mortuary, says, you know what, we'll make room in the cemetery and we'll bury your shamos. Where did they put the shamos in Cairo? It wasn't Cairo, it was called Fasat. They put it up in the attic of the shul. Unlike the climate in New Jersey, you have a dry, arid climate in Egypt. So the documents and the shamos that they put up there have lasted throughout the millennia. So you read it, it's fascinating. All their major questions, their communal issues, the communal shilas, they would send from North Africa to Babylonia. That's where the Gedolei Yisrael were. By the way, you see, fascinating, all these fundraising documents. It was their job to send their wealth to Babylonia, because that's where they would send people to be educated. And then you see letters saying, well, you know, how come you're not sending the way you used to? And they responded back, because now we're developing our own communities in North Africa. We have our own institutions, our own we're producing our own rabbis. You know, same kind of things you get between Israel and America today. But what happened? Under the period that we call the Amoraim, the period of the Talmud, under the period of the Rabban Savroi, under the period of the Gaonim, the majority of world Jewry lived in Babel and they flourished there. Then what happened? Nothing radical. Nothing drastic. Slowly but surely, over a period of maybe 2 to 3 centuries, slowly but surely, you have, as business opportunities open up, Jews start to move. Two main paths out of Babel. North Africa, what we call today Tunisia, Morocco, Egypt, these areas. And the second is what we call into Italy. You had the famous rabbi, Nassim Bala Aruch, the encyclopedic work, the Aruch. He lived in Rome. Bari in southern Italy, port town, had great scholars. Rabbeinu Tam writes, you know the famous verse, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah? Ki Mibari Teitzei Torah. So slowly but surely, out of this center of Babylonia, you're getting two new centers. From Italy, they move north into northern Italy. There's a famous family in northern Italy. It's called the Colonimus family. Colonimus is a Greek term which is the equivalent in Hebrew of Shem Tov. They were revered, they were respected, they were beloved. The Colonimus family moves and takes with them from Italy Jews into the German Rhineland. And they settle in the cities along the Rhine River. Mainz and Worms and Spires. Right? Those of you who have the last name Shapiro descends eventually from Spires. But the primary community is Mainz. So now what's happened is the Mesorah, along with the Jews, is not just rooted on the Euphrates River, but primarily the Mesorah and the scholars of the Mesorah have moved via Italy into the German Rhineland. It also moves when the Moors cross the Iberian Peninsula into Spain. It moves with the Jews from North Africa into Spain. And there actually are more Sephardic Jews than there are Ashkenazic Jews. However, the seat of the Mesorah has now been transferred from where? From Surin Pumpadisa to Mainz. Who is the Baal HaMesorah? The famous Rabbeinu Gershom, Maor Einei HaGola. The Rabbeinu Gershom who enlightened the eyes of the diaspora. We've got Jews going from England, from Spain, from, believe it or not, Babel, from Babylonia, from Bohemia, from Austria, from France, from Provence, coming to Mainz, Germany, to study under Rabbeinu Gershom. You're all familiar with the famous Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom? He convened in the city of Worms the leaders of Ashkenaz, the scholars from Bohemia, from Austria, from France, etc. And they put a Cherem. You know, today you have these people who read other people's emails, right? Well, in those days, you know, you had international trade, and Jews were fantastic in international trade. what would happen is I would send a document to someone who was traveling to a certain place. Please bring it to so-and-so. And what would be in that document? Hey, I've got from the feudal lord, or I've got a monopoly to import sugar. If you can bring sugar, I'll split the proceeds with you, 60-40 or whatever the deal was. The same thing with other minerals, the same thing with other spices, you name it, salt, sugar. Well, imagine reading that document. You can steal the contract. If you read the guy's mail, the document that he's asked you to take to another country or to another part of the world, you can cut in on him and cut him out. Right? Nothing against the Chinese, but what the Chinese have been doing to Jewish middlemen over the last 30 years. That's essentially, right? Walmart doesn't go through the Jewish middlemen anymore. They go straight to the factory in China. That's the cherem on reading someone else's mail. What's the cherem on polygamy? If you talk to Rabbi Wolf, Rabbi Dr. Wolf, he was a Talmud of the Rav, he got his PhD at Harvard from Rabbi Tversky in the Maharik. Maharik was important. Yosef Kalon was one of these transition figures between the Rishonim and Achronim who settled in northern Italy. But Rabbi Wolf says, and he backs this up, if you ask him, maybe he'll come as a scholar in residence, if he could give a shir on this, but the upshot of the shir is, you have these, it's not like what everybody says, oh, the Christians, they despise and they look down upon polygamy, so how could it be a chil Hashem, how could the Jews have polygamous relationships? That's what many people say. He said, no. He said, all these Jewish businessmen, all these Jewish traders from Ashkenaz, who are off doing business, they meet a nice Sephardic girl, or a nice Iraqi girl, and they have a family, a second family, so instead of being off for a month or two, they stay 6 or 8 or 2 years. And Nebuch, the wife back in Ashkenaz, is Naguna. Because the husband spends more time away from home in the name of business where he's got a second family. Maybe it's a younger wife. Maybe it's a prettier wife. Maybe they treat their husbands better than the women did in Germany and France. Who knows? It's for sure a better climate there. And the Chachamim put a cherem against that. Because that's a violation of the Hafler Kamok. How do you treat your wife? How do you let her sit there alone? So he was the heart and soul of the Masorah. There's a wunderkind who grows up in a little town in northern France by the name of Troyes. T-R-O-Y-E-S, Troyes. That little Dorf Troyes, maybe it had more people than the 830 Nusach Sfarad Minyan, but not a lot. Okay? It was a small town. They don't have great scholars in France. Just like they don't have great scholars in Bohemia, England, or anywhere else. Because you know where the great scholars are? Where is the seat of the Masorah? It's in Mainz. And then after Rabbeinu Gershom passes away, his Talmidim open up schools in Worms. So they send the Wunderkind to get the great education in Mainz. And then he learns part of his time in Mainz and part of the time in Worms. And guess what? The second great miracle, and I'm not saying this is in any way, I'm saying it not as a joke, I'm saying it seriously. The second great miracle in Jewish history is that after all those years of school, the hometown folk bring the Wunderkind back home to be their rabbi. Now, we have a principle, you know from the Gemara. Ein Navi Be'iro. You can be a prophet to the Jewish people, but there's no such thing as a prophet in your own hometown. Ein Navi Be'iro. You know why? Because in your own hometown, they remember you running around in diapers. They remember you on Simchas Torah when you were taking everybody's talisim and twisting them in knots. It's hard for them, when they know your warts and pimples, to look up to you. But for some reason, and that, I'm telling you that you'll see why this was a great miracle. They brought the Wunderkind home to be their rabbi. And he had one basic condition. He wanted to bring with him a small kolo. He wanted to bring with him a number of his students. Key students. His student, Rabbeinu Simcha, the author of the Machzor Vitri. Our Yom Tov would not be Yom Tov if it were not for that Machzor Vitri. A number of his students become his sons-in-law. One of the great ones is Meir, who produces two of his children, the Rashbam, Shmuel ben Meir and the famous Rabbeinu Tam. Maybe after Rashi, the greatest Ashkenazic Jew. And what happens? He writes something. See, we call it Rashi, but that's not the name of his commentary. What's the name of his commentary? You'll always see in the Rishonim, Pei, excuse me, Pei Hei. What's Pei Hei? Peirush HaKuntras.
The commentary of the Kuntras. What's the Kuntras?
The Mesorah that started with Moshe Rabbeinu, that was in Israel all those years, that goes through Rabbi Akiva, right, through the Beis Hillel and the Beis Shammai, that goes through his five students, that their five students produce students like Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi produces students, and that Mesorah travels to Bava. The Mesorah, the Balei HaMesorah, that now travels from Bava to the German Rhineland.
Rashi writes down in a brilliant way.
Rashi was not a pulpit rabbi. He didn't get paid by the word. Rashi has this amazing way, in four words, in five words, in six words, of taking the issue, and not just transmitting the Mesorah, but from those five words, you can wrestle with his words, and you can get what were the arguments, what were the discussions, what was the analysis, what were the issues they were grappling with. He didn't make up his commentary. That is the Mesorah of Judaism.
How do we analyze financial law? How do we analyze agricultural law? The philosophical aspects, the psychological aspects, the axioms, the postulates. And what he did was, he wrote that down in a brilliant way that you could, by analyzing his words, you could recreate the discussions. You can recreate the issues and the struggles.
Now why is that such a miracle that they took him back to France?
For the following reason. Remember, Rashi is an exception. He's maybe one of the few top scholars of the schools of the Mesorah of Mines and Worms that happens not to be in the German Rhineland. In 1096, Godfrey of Bouillon, right, who's a church leader in France, what does he do? He's going to start the Crusade. These chayas and animals who are incarcerated, he's going to emancipate them, liberate them, and he's going to give them indulgences if they go and liberate the Holy Land. They liberate Palestine from the infidel Muslims. The knights, you know what a knight is? A knight is basically a thug who's got a license to carry a weapon. That's all that a knight is. Contrary to the way they're written in history and in the movies. And the French Jews are getting really nervous and really scared, rightfully so. There's this religious fervor. They're going to defeat the infidels. Well, you know something? Worse than the Muslim infidels, in your own backyard, you got Jewish infidels. But why are we worse than the Muslims? Because the Muslims didn't kill your God. They didn't kill your Lord. We're guilty of deicide. And we have documents. The German Jews are sending money to the French Jews so they can bribe the local officials to protect them. The German Jews are davening, they're saying Tehillim for the French Jews. They never thought for a second it would befall them. You know why? Because Lacroix was not part of what was happening in Germany. But something unexpected, unanticipated took place in Germany. The People's Crusade. The People's Crusade was not led by Godfrey of Bouillon. It was something that was started by the masses, and it had a life of its own. And instead of traveling towards the Middle East, it went up the Rhine River. We, in our kinos on Chaf Hei, go through the destruction of three towns, the 23rd of Iyar, Spires, and then they came back. Originally, they killed 10 of the scholars who were outside the Jewish community in Spires and paid bribe money to the bishop. So most of the Jews were protected originally. Then they came back and were killed. On Rosh Chodesh Iyar, I'm sorry, Rosh Chodesh Sivan, the Worms was wiped out. The Balei HaMesorah, the Chachmei HaMesorah, they were just wiped out. They were annihilated. You know, till Hitler, the Jews of Worms fasted every Rosh Chodesh Sivan. You know, you can't fast on Shulchan Aruch, you're not allowed to fast Rosh Chodesh. They fasted because it was the destruction of their community. Wiped out. You know how many times when a Polish rabbi would be imported to Germany and he would try a Chai V'Kayim, you can't fast, it's against Shulchan Aruch. You know how many Polish rabbis were fired trying to be the rabbi of Worms? That didn't last until there was no longer a Worms Jew. The third, as you lead in Kinochas Hei, the third of Sivan, Mainz was annihilated, was destroyed. But it wasn't just Mainz and Worms and Spires. It was the small villages. It was other cities.
There's another crusade led by Peter the Hermit, and the Jews in Austria and other parts of Germany are wiped out. The Misora, the seed of the Misora, not just Jews, but the whole Misora was obliterated. It was annihilated. If we didn't have Rashi, now Rashi's older this time, because the French crusaders did not do what the German crusaders did. It was difficult, it was uncomfortable, but the French Jews were not killed, were not tortured. You had a choice. You accept baptism, you kiss the cross, or you die. And not only did we die, Ruba the Ruba, the large majority of Jews, but it's written about in the 22nd Kingdom. Mothers and fathers killed their young. We killed our own children. Because what were the crusaders going to do to us? They were going to butcher and kill us and then raise the children as Trinitarians. Rather than having our children raised as being Odei Avodah Zarah, we killed our own. And the Tosfos speak about this, and the author of the Kinna, the 22nd Kinna, speaks about this. Had it not been for Rashi, and at this point he's an older man, through his grandchildren, Judaism survived. Who are his grandchildren? The Bali Tosfos. The Bali Tosfos and their students. And their students' students. And in the aftermath of the destruction of the Misora, they do three things. It's actually two things they do and one thing they don't do. Number one, answering the question we started with, they now observe Sfira not the way they used to. They observe Sfira from Rosh Chodesh Iyar until the Shosh Hashemei Hagbala, those 33 days. Why? Because that was a period of the destruction of the Misora. I'm quoting the Ma'arival, the famous transition figure of Yaakov Weil. You know what he says? Our Avelus is not Avelus Yeshana. The mourning during Sfira that we're mourning is not just the students of Rebbe Akiva, the destruction of the Misora. It's Avelus Chadasha. It's a new mourning. It's the mourning of the Balei HaMisora, of the destruction where Judaism was almost lost. In our lifetime, in our people, in our homeland. All of Ashkenaz now functions out of France at this point. The Ri of Dampir, Rabbeinu Tam, the Rosh Mishantz, Evro. It's destruction of the Misora. Second thing they do, Av HaRachamim. You know the original Minhag Ashkenaz? You say Av HaRachamim twice a year. The Shabbos before Shavuos, because that's when minds and worms were destroyed. And the Shabbos, what you call Shabbos Chazon, what Ashkenazic Jewry referred to as, before Ozzy Osbourne, of course, the Black Sabbath. Shvat Shabbos. The Shvat Shabbos, the Black Sabbath. Twice a year. Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, the Shabbos before Shavuos. Polish minhag was that to commemorate this this pogrom and to commemorate this tragedy, they started saying it and expanding it more and more and more. By the time they were done, you were saying Nebuch because of all the Jewish tragedies and sorrows throughout our history. You ended up saying Av HaRachamim more than you didn't say it. The third thing, and that's what's discussed in the 25th Kinna. They sat and they said we should declare a fast day, a day of Ashkenazic mourning. And they said no. To quote the Kinna, the Chi'ein Lahosiv. You can't add on to Tisha B'Av. You can't bring a day before nor a day afterwards. And they decided we're going to mourn this. We're going to mourn this when? On Tisha B'Av. It didn't take place in August. It took place in May and June. But all destruction, all churban stems from what? It stems from the Seal of Kashchina. When God's providential relationship, when He removed that intense providential relationship and allowed Titus to come into the base of Mikdash on the afternoon of the 9th of Av, all Churban stems from that. And they said, we're not going to have a day of mourning to commemorate it in Iyar Sivan. It's going to be in Tisha B'Av. So what happened? We mourn on Tisha B'Av. And we're going to end with this. We mourn on Tisha B'Av not just the death of communities, not just the macro death, not just the death of individuals, which is what we've spoken about in the past. We also mourn the fact that they destroyed our precious Masorah. What would Judaism have been had not the Chochmei Ashkenaz been annihilated? We have one remnant, we have Rashi. And if you look in the 22nd Kina, which is in your sheets, it says, we can't understand Nazir, we can't understand the Sefer Nedarim, because we don't have the Masorah from the school of Rabbeinu Gershom. Had Rashi not survived, it would have all been annihilated. We mourn the destruction of the Masorah. That's what Chaf Beis and Chaf Hei are. That's the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva. That's the death and destruction of the Chochmei Ashkenaz. And that is part of the experience we go through this time of year. Thank you.